Hi everyone, this is John Himmel, and I'm here to do a podcast on intimate partner violence interventions on behalf of the Association of Domestic Violence Intervention Programs. Today, I'm very pleased to have as our guest Erica Lawrence, who is a research professor in the psychology department at Northwestern University. She's also director of translational studies or translational science in that department, and she is also a clinician in the Family Institute at Northwestern University. And Erica has done research in many different aspects of domestic violence, including the impact of domestic violence on victims. And today I'm going to ask her about her approach to batterer intervention programs using the ACT or ACT, the treatment philosophy, which is becoming more and more widely used in the field of psychotherapy in general. ACT is the acronym for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, Erica, let me just start by asking you kind of a broad question to get us going here. What is ACT, and how does it compare to other psychotherapy models, especially CBT, because it's kind of an offshoot of CBT, the way I look at it.
It is. I would say it's built on the shoulders of CBT. So there was the first wave of behavior therapy, and CBT was the second wave, and ACT is part of the third wave of behavior therapy. It's really an approach to therapy, and it's based, without getting too much into the weeds, it's based on functional contextualism as a philosophy and then relational frame theory as a theory. But it really just, it's a way of targeting the processes of language that we hypothesize are involved in psychopathology or the amelioration of psychopathology. And there are six different main processes that we target. So one of them is moving people from cognitive fusion to defusion. So this idea that we get hooked on certain thoughts or fused with certain thoughts, and that really limits our ability to function in the world. And to make sort of flexible choices in a given moment. And so there are several techniques trying to help people unhook or defuse from certain thoughts. There's moving people from experiential avoidance to emotional acceptance, which is, so experiential avoidance is when someone is really unwilling to remain in contact with certain internal experiences. Could be unpleasant thoughts, feelings, memories, urges. But so they're trying to avoid them or change them or control them, and all of their energy and time really gets caught up in this experiential avoidance. And so we try to move people to what we call emotional acceptance, which is being willing to allow those internal experiences, those thoughts and feelings to be there, even though they're unwanted, so that we can focus our time and attention on other things, such as living our lives.
So someone who's broadly categorized as being neurotic, would be someone who's preoccupied with thoughts of what's going to happen in the future, obsessing about little things. Someone with anxiety disorder or someone who's depressed might be preoccupied with self-defeating thoughts. And the ACT approach, how would you differentiate it between regular cognitive behavioral therapy, where negative thoughts are challenged and disputed?
I think the biggest difference is that, as you said, thoughts may be labeled in CBT as negative or wrong or bad, and so the goal is to change them or challenge them in some way. And I think the underlying assumption there is that changing the thoughts will lead to changes in behavior or changes in symptoms. And within ACT, what we do is we teach people to notice the thoughts, but instead of trying to control, change, or get rid of them, we teach them to be willing to have those thoughts in the moment, allow them to be there, and then still make different behavioral choices based on what really is important in the moment. So the thoughts don't influence the behavior, you just allow them to be there, and then you can really focus on how you want to behave in a given moment.
Does that mean that that approach to observing and distancing yourself from your thoughts would be incompatible with CBT, or can the two approaches both be used, or does it matter? Does it depend on the client or the type of problem that they have?
They definitely are not incompatible. I think that piece of it often feels incompatible. But you could even suggest that teaching someone to challenge a thought or see a thought as something that could be changed within CBT is just one approach to defusing from the thought, which would be an act. So I think, yeah, I do think it depends. I would say most of us who use ACT or third wave behavior approaches don't believe that we can really change thoughts. I mean, some of the tenets of ACT are that we can't delete or subtract language once it's, in our minds.
Right.
We can add to it, we can create new thoughts, but we can't remove thoughts. So we would say that trying to change them or get rid of them doesn't work.
Well, to be fair to the CBT approach, which I've been using for many years, we'll say that at least the way I work with clients is I'm not sure that I promise them that they're going to be able to get rid of their thoughts, but at the very least, what we try to do with a straight CBT approach is to have our clients, first of all, try to identify the thoughts that they do have that are not necessarily bad, not a judgment. It's more like, are they dysfunctional? Are they distorted? So the idea is that if you have certain ways of thinking that that just exaggerate the problem or cause you to get angry or more emotional than you should be, then you need to be aware of those thoughts, and then you need to come up with a more realistic way of looking at things. So it's not necessarily that we're asking them to get rid of their thoughts. We're saying, for example, you're at Starbucks and you order a cappuccino and you get a latte, and your thought is, "What an idiot." And we would identify that thought as mind reading or labeling, and we would point out to the client that, well, is this person really an idiot, or is this person just maybe having a bad day? Your thought about that situation caused you to feel angry unnecessarily. Therefore, what's a more reasonable way to look at the situation? Blah, 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 right? So we would have them go through this process either in a conversation or through their monthly cognitive logs. And so the idea isn't we don't necessarily expect that the client will never have those kind of thoughts again, but we would hope that the next time they're in a similar situation, that they may at least be aware that those kind of distorted thoughts might come up, and that to be aware of them so they can act differently. So it's more a matter of identifying the thoughts. Ultimately, I guess that the long-term goal with CBT, at least the way I practice it, is that at some point these thoughts will diminish and no longer be as important as they used to be. But I don't know if any. If I necessarily believe that they're going to be eliminated. The problem with one of the limitations that I found with just straight CBT is a lot of clients find it difficult to do the logs and have a hard time with the whole idea that they can critically evaluate their own thinking. So getting clients and batter intervention groups to just buy into the idea that they can look at their thoughts and they can dispute them is hard for them. And that's why I'm so intrigued with ACT. Because with ACT, it's a completely different approach. It just seems, I don't know, in some ways, it seems a little easier for clients to kind of to buy into, if you know what I mean.
Yes, may I back up and clarify something? Because I apologize if I hit a nerve. Because just a reminder that I have used CBT for decades with offenders and victims and was trained in CBT when I was in graduate school. The notion of people trying to get rid of their thoughts and letting people know that that doesn't work is a part of ACT and how we deal with cognitive defusion, not part of CBT. And so I didn't mean to send you off on a sideways. I was just trying to explain how we target thoughts differently, but I do think that thinking about labeling thoughts or generating others could be one way of defusing from ACT. So it could be one example within that larger framework.
I guess what I'm saying, Erica, is that when I work with clients using a straight CBT approach, I think sometimes I think the people that I train and sometimes the clients get into their heads that they're supposed to get rid of these thoughts. And I'm just saying that I know that that's not the case. That's not what we're trying to do. So. What I was saying is, it seems to me that with a lot of clients, they just find the straight CBT approach a little difficult. It takes psychologically minded people seem to have an easier time using CBT. Do you agree with that?
Compared to apt
Yeah,
or
right.
no, respectfully, I don't agree with that. I think where people struggle is, because I think some people really struggle with CBT, some of our clients, and some of our clients really struggle with ACT. I think one of the people who've been trained in CBT or use CBT have difficulty then transitioning into using ACT approaches. And I certainly was one of those people when I made that transition.
Oh, okay. For what reason?
Because we're so used to targeting the thoughts or the feelings and trying to come up with new alternatives. And what we're seeing with our clients now or our participants is that to allow those thoughts to be there and not struggle with them or try to control them. And that's really hard for people to do. Their goal is, I want to get rid of these thoughts, they're uncomfortable, or I want to get rid of these feelings or these urges, they're uncomfortable, I don't want them here. And as if that has to happen before they can start really living their lives. And we're saying allow those uncomfortable thoughts or feelings or urges or memories to be there and live your life at the same time. And that's really hard for people to make that transition and be willing to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's kind of my experience as well. It just seems some people just respond to ACT better than others, and vice versa. Let me ask you about your background with, since you already mentioned having been a proponent of CBT for a long time. So, how long has ACT been around, and what kind of populations has it been used with primarily before you and your colleagues began to implement it in the context of batter intervention?
It's been around for decades, but really started to gain popularity and momentum, I'd say, in the 2000s. I mean, now there have been hundreds of studies looking at it as an effective treatment for depression, for PTSD, agoraphobia, substance use, chronic pain with couples, with anger, a whole host of different adaptations.
Well, I went to a conference in San Francisco about 5 years ago, ACT conference, and it seems like a lot of practitioners use it pretty effectively, apparently, with drug and alcohol problems. And it seems to fit pretty well or mesh pretty well with the 12-step program approaches, the higher power concept and letting go, things like that. And of course, it's used quite a bit with people with various anxiety disorders. Tell me about the research on ACT, and what do you know about how effective ACT is compared to CBT for various types of problems? And I'm not right now asking about your own studies with batter intervention, but just in terms of ACT's overall effectiveness compared to other psychotherapy approaches.
Well, I think initially the research was really just looking at it, not trying to compare it to CBT. And now there are more studies comparing it to other approaches that are really showing that it's more effective in all of these outcome studies that have been published.
In what effective and according to what criterion?
According to they've looked at, because it depends, again, there are hundreds of studies. So some of them have looked at symptom reduction, some of them have looked at increasing decreasing functional impairment.
Right.
It really, I mean, it some of them have looked at sort of outside criteria, like we look at recidivism, other people will look at those kinds of behaviors. It really varies across the hundreds of studies.
Yeah, by symptom reduction, for example, less anxiety, less reported feelings of anger or depression, being able to manage daily activities more effectively, improve relationships, those kinds of outcomes.
Yes, and I do think, just as a caveat, that one of the, I guess what most people, and you may disagree, see as a difference between CBT and ACT is that the CBT, the target is symptom reduction, generally speaking, and or behavioral reduction in the case of looking at IPV. And with ACT, the goal actually is not symptom reduction. That might be a nice side benefit, but the goal is not symptom reduction. It's willingness to experience the symptoms and improve functioning.
Right, and that's one of the things I really like about ACT, and that's I think that may be one of the reasons why it seems to fit in well with the 12-step philosophy in some ways, that it's about change, acceptance, and commitment therapy. So the commitment part is just as important, if not more important than just the acceptance part, accepting your emotions, but then committing to moving forward and making changes in your life. So Erica, talk about that piece of it, because that's the part that fascinates me. It's not just learning to detach from these thoughts, these dysfunctional and self-defeating thoughts. It's also finding ways to change your life. Now, in 12-step programs, there's a lot of discussion about fake it till you make it. Act as if you were a responsible person, even if you feel like you want to act out. And so, talk a little bit about how ACT encourages people to set goals based on their on values and so forth.
So earlier when I was mentioning there are sort of six processes, like I talked about cognitive fusion, experiential avoidance, and there are four more. Two of them you've just alluded to. So one is really focusing on identifying values and having our behaviors consistent with our values and having that drive our behavioral choices every day. And a lot of people we find haven't, no one's have, people haven't asked them what they value, what's important to them. Or people will identify goals but not values. And then that, or they'll confuse goals with values or other values problems can underlie their failure to build sort of flexible repertoires of behavior. And so helping people identify their values is a really critical piece of it and having that guide your behavior. The commitment piece is building a larger repertoire of behavior through commitment to behavior that moves you toward your chosen values. So when we think about, so I'll often ask clients, you know, what is that behavior moving you toward that value as opposed to away from the unwanted internal experience? And so the commitment to the behavior and the idea is that we make this commitment every day or every moment. And so it's not, you never achieve your value. You are always moving toward your value and making behavioral choices that are difficult, but they move you toward your values every day.
So, give me an example, Erica, of what that would look like with someone who is in a batterer intervention program where they are, you know, obviously expected to end their violence. And so, and also maybe touch on motivational interviewing, because a lot of what ACT is trying to do seems like it's very much related to motivational interviewing goals where you're getting clients to come up with their own solutions as much as possible, instead of always having to tell them how they should, you know, live their lives. But getting them to set their goals. And so what would that look like with a batterer intervention client? How would you use ACT to get them to start setting goals that feel right for them that would also be in line with what, you know, we as society would expect from these clients?
Well, I would say we start with having them talk about values as opposed to goals.
Okay.
And really identifying, and I would say in that context, most of the men that we work with have never been asked that or haven't been thought, you know, it's so much is focused on their current behavior or their recent behavior and to say, what is it that you want your life to look like? What do you want people to say about you
Right.
50 years from now? What really matters to you? And what we find, generally speaking, is that their values are not that different from anyone else's. I think that's a misunderstanding that people have. But so they will often say respect or relationships or family or being a good parent or being a good relationship partner. And then the discussion comes around what are some things you could be doing that would move you toward that? Or how, I'll say, if I were a fly on the wall, how would I know that respect matters to you? And it's really shifting that their focus from my partner respecting me, you know, what my partner's doing to what I'm doing. So for example, someone might say, you know, what matters to me is that she do what I want her to do or that she listen to me. And I'll say, okay, well, why does that matter to you? Why is that important? You know, and you keep sort of doing this sort of almost Socratic questioning until you get to the actual value, which often is respect. And so then you have them look at their behavior choices and whether those are moving them toward being a respectful person.
Right.
The other value that becomes really relevant with offenders is freedom. And we don't think about that when we're working with most clients, I think, or using ACT in other contexts, but freedom is a value, obviously. And, you know, with, even if that's staying out of jail, we wanted to change the behavior.
Exactly. Do you agree that what ACT is doing kind of dovetails with some other approaches that have been used, at least by some batterer intervention programs, including the strengths, so-called strength-based approaches and motivational interviewing, where you're trying to tap into clients' better nature? And it just seems that it's more comprehensive because you're really you're getting them to dig deeper, like you said, besides looking at their goals, looking at their values, which it seems to me would, by digging deeper, maybe clients become more committed to change because they're, I don't know, they're aligning what they're supposed to be doing with things they really care about.
I would say yes, those are all, I think, complementary and arguably part of this sort of third wave approach to trying to facilitate change. One of the things that's unique about ACT is this idea of trying to build intrinsic instead of extrinsic motivation when we're working with offenders. And trying to figure out what that intrinsic motivation is for each person and having that motivate them to change their behavior and reduce their violence. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's one of the reasons why our program is effective.
Well, let's go ahead and transition right into the next line of questioning, which is are there studies that have shown ACT to be effective in terms of this population that we're focusing on today, the batterers and batterer intervention? What kind of studies have been done by yourself and by others, and what kind of results are we getting?
So far, all of the research has been done by myself or Amy Zarling. And I want to just clarify that she is at least half responsible, or gets half the credit for the development, translation, and success of this program. Mm-hmm. She was my grad student and later my postdoc when we were developing this intervention. But I do think sometimes that grad students, and particularly women, don't necessarily get credit for their contributions and collaborations. And I just want to make sure that she is acknowledged. But all the studies have been done either by her or me and our collaborators. We've done a number of feasibility and pilot studies. We did an efficacy study. And then I think the most telling one was an effectiveness study that was a statewide study comparing it to comparing ACTIVE, which is our intervention, to the traditional standard program that's used in almost every state in the country, which is a hybrid of Duluth and CBT. And we did it within, I think we had a much higher bar because we compared it to an existing intervention, not an attention placebo or no treatment control. And we did it out in the community. So we were not choosing the participants. We had no control over who was running the groups or where the setting. And we found that we reduced recidivism by a third compared 1 year out compared to the existing treatment that's used. And we just got in the process of finishing up a paper to send out where we appear to be replicating that in another state.
What kind of clients? Were they court mandated?
They're all court mandated. So these are all in community-based corrections, so not in the jails. But men who are all court mandated to attend these usually 24-week programs is what most states mandate. So that's another sort of challenge that most of the research looking at ACT has been done with clients who volunteer for treatment, and here we're doing it with people who are court mandated.
That's pretty impressive. I was intrigued by what would happen once you move beyond just the voluntary client stage. How many clients were involved in this study we're just referring to?
In that one, I think the final sample was about 3,000, but we found the findings after several hundred. It took till we got to several thousand to get it published. But
several thousand clients?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
It was a statewide intervention, and hundreds of men go through these BEP programs every year. So
yeah, okay. So tell us a little bit more about, this is very important, and we have some time, Erica. We're going to be doing another follow-up podcast focusing on clinical issues. So we have a little bit of time in this particular portion. So let's give me a little bit more a sense of the study, how people were recruited, how they were assigned to the different treatment conditions, anything that came up that was problematic. Any findings that were surprising or not surprising? Just tell us a little bit more about the methodology and the results of this particular study, because it sounds really, really important.
Thank you. Well, remember, it's an effectiveness study. So I think when people think about RCTs, they're used to thinking about highly controlled efficacy studies run in the lab, which is increases your internal validity, but really lowers your external validity. We were doing an effectiveness trial where we're doing it out in the community with the people running these groups. So we can't use any inclusion or exclusion criteria for our participants. They were court mandated. We didn't choose the sites. We didn't even choose the people running the groups. Whoever the Department of Corrections hired to run these groups and told we're running these groups, we're running them. So not only were the participants not voluntary, but most of our group facilitators were not volunteering. Most of them did not have any mental health or counseling training. These were people who worked for the Department of Corrections. Sometimes they were POs. Sometimes they had experience running groups. They all certainly had experience with DV. That those were some of the challenges. We also, again, because it's an effectiveness trial, don't have the power to randomly assign people to either condition. I would say it was quasi-random because the only there were groups run in every single district, both active and treatment as usual. And so the only factors in terms of what group they were in is their schedule. So there were groups that were in both
Okay.
conditions, day, evening, weekend, weekday. So that was the only thing. So it was random to that extent, but we did not randomly assign people.
Right. So it was quasi-experimental, Erica, in terms of statistical procedures and all that. But I do know that when you don't have random assignment to conditions, the second best thing is to try to control for the different factors to see if you can approximate the two, the treatment and the control group, statistically controlled by trying to keep certain variables the same. So I'm just asking, as part of your analyses, did that involve trying to see if you could find any differences across the treatment conditions when you held constant certain factors like number of previous offenses or socioeconomic data and so forth?
Some of those facts, that study in particular was published by Amy, so I don't want to speak for her, but yes, all of those factors were certainly considered in the replication that we're about to send out. We compared the two groups and made sure they matched on breakdown of age categories and race and ethnicity and risk level, that all of the people were assessed. We're given two different assessments to assess their risk, and so they're matched on risk level.
Okay, so that's actually a pretty sound study.
Yes,
Not
I
not,
so.
and as you know, I just want to say this for our listeners who may not all be aware of all the research, but the research that was conducted in Broward County, Florida, and in Brooklyn, New York, some time ago, that supposedly found these programs to not be effective, were supposedly based on random assignment to condition methodology, but actually, it wasn't perfect random assignment to condition. There were at least one of those locales, the judge at some point stopped randomly assigning and just started assigning people based on what he thought was best for them. So even the most thought out randomized control trials aren't always done correctly. And as you said, they sometimes have their own problems. They're not necessarily generalized. They don't necessarily generalize to a larger population. With the studies that I'm just mentioning, there were questions about the ability of the facilitators, the size of the groups, and so forth and so on.
Well, and I agree with you, and I would say that one of the nice things over the last handful of years is the emergence of the field of implementation science, which is the world in which I work. And
Now tell us
really
about that.
just the well, so this idea, this education of all of the different stages of developing an intervention and running feasibility trials and pilot and efficacy versus effectiveness and different kinds of efficacy trials and dissemination and implementation and the importance of all of those stages of evaluating and disseminating an implementation and really educating, I think, clinicians and researchers that the traditional RCT in your lab is one kind of evaluation that has some strengths and limitations to it and is no longer considered the gold standard. But there are certainly some people who still consider it, but this importance of really getting out to the world and disseminating and doing implementation work and trying to evaluate your programs in the real world with the people who are doing it and see if they're effective in that context with all of the challenges that come with that. And that's really where the field has moved. And so I'm proud that we've been at the forefront of that.
I'd love to know more about this. At some other time, I'll maybe contact you. I really want to know more about implementation science. Mm-hmm. I'll just say this. In my own focus, my own research recently has been to look at process factors, in particular, how group facilitators engage clients in group. And that just seems mm-hmm. to me a very promising line of research because you're looking at factors that cross theoretical lines. And it just seems to be more relevant to outcomes than simply comparing, say, CBT with Duluth or some other theoretical model. What else can you say about your findings? Anything that was surprising? Did you have hypotheses that were supported or not supported?
I can say a couple of things, and some were related to that particular study, and some I'm just talking about our cluster of studies that we've done over the last decade. One thing to address your point about the importance of facilitator style, I think that's critical, and one of the things that's really important in ACTIVE, in our intervention, is using a collaborative style as opposed to a confrontational style. Now, most groups at this point use more of a collaborative style. Certainly CBT is a collaborative approach, and even many Duluth groups now use more of a collaborative approach. So one of the things that we did look at was we rated every single facilitator, in all of these groups on a scale from confrontational to collaborative. We audio taped all of the sessions and then randomly chose 20% of them to be coded by a separate team that had nothing else to do with the project. And they rated all the facilitators, and then we looked at whether that moderated any of the findings, and it didn't. Because that's a common question that comes up. The other thing I thought that's been really interesting is that there were some people initially who really thought that this was about taking ACT and plunking it down into a different situation with a different target behavior, and that it would work. And it's Sonia Demigian has referred to this as the green eggs and ham approach. Mm-hmm. Where you say, okay, ACT works to target this problem. Let's pick it up and lower it into this problem exactly as it is, and then it should still work. There are some people who tried to do that and pull out everything else and just do ACT, and they did not find anything compared to treatment as usual. That's not work that Amy or I did, but others tried to do that. And I think it really talks about the importance of how we adapted ACT specifically based on the decades of biobehavioral research on intimate partner violence. And so there's a lot of content on IPV in there. The way we talk about the processes is related to IPV behaviors, the examples, the techniques, the concepts, session by session. It's really adapted as opposed to just sort of lifting ACT and putting it down there. So I think that's one thing that I guess didn't surprise me, but surprised some people, that it's not simply let's just take ACT and put it in this population. It's the way we've adapted it within the context of IPV.